episode 147, 147 episodes without a miss. Welcome to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, where, haven't done this in a while, Bear, we don't just break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, pop culture. We break kayfabe on life. That's a shout out for all those people that have missed that. Barry, how you doing, my man?
I'm doing good. So that's amazing too, and you're right. But that your voice sounds fantastic. It's like you're 100%. You're back. You're ready to rock and roll. So not to play Nostradamus here, Jeff, but just wondering, 147 episodes we've never missed. Will we ever miss an episode? And what will be the reason for missing the episode? What do you think it's going to be?
Well, let's see. We made it past cancer.
Yes.
Made it past a wedding.
We did.
Let's see.
You moved.
I moved. Yes.
Right. Out of state. In state.
I think you done an episode from, down there in Clearwater or whatever? You know, we've done the remote locations.
Yes, we've done those.
You know, I know without a shadow of a doubt that the great Brian Last certainly appreciates our hard work and our good efforts, Barry.
Does he? Because I wouldn't know that. I would have no idea if that's actually accurate.
I lobbed you up a softball and you hit it out of the park. I'm proud of you. So on today's episode, Barry, we are going to be going back to, good Lord, Barry, I just realized this before we started recording, June 19th, 1979. I had just graduated high school. Yes, now everyone knows how old I am. As we are going to the hallowed halls of Memphis TV, and we're going to be having some fun with this one, Barry. Then we're going to be, I believe the first time in the history of this fine podcast, Barry, we're going to be breaking one of our own rules because we're going to be talking politics, but we're going to be talking local politics, and it involves someone that I know personally, or I knew personally, haven't seen them in about a year. That's another thing, Barry. I realized the other day that 2 weeks from now is my one-year anniversary from leaving my job of 33 and a half years. Woo, boy, that year flew by. We're going to be recommending a YouTube film that was just posted up on YouTube that is absolutely fantastic, a documentary that was done in 1972 about wrestling at the Sam Houston Coliseum in Houston, and it is fantastic. Can't recommend it enough. Then we're going to be looking – Barry, nothing our fans like more than a good story about people shitting. Is that fair to say?
Oh, it's Jeff. We've always said, I think the legacy, I'm not going to speak for you. I think it's a little different, but the legacy that I will leave, and you can look at Joe Christie because he posts one Ethiopian or shit related meme per day in our Facebook group. My legacy is going to be the shit stories. And I can't say that I'm proud of it, but I'm not really embarrassed by it. But I do have a good one that I've never shared before.
Well, and leading into that story is an article that my wife told me about.
Yes.
Involving sugarless gummy bears. Now, were you familiar with this phenomenon before I told you about it, Barry?
This is what caused the stomach issue. So,
So you did know. And finally, we're going to be looking at another top five list. People love our top five list, Barry.
What?
Today, top five opening scenes to a movie.
Yeah. And Jeff, I got to say, first off, your picks are much better than mine. Yeah. I'm not spoiling anything. You've got two on there. One is, I would say, the greatest opening scene of, I don't know. You got both of them and I'm going back and forth. You have got two on there that I think are one and two of the greatest opening scenes of any movies ever.
Well, let me just specify that these are not the greatest. These are our personal favorites.
That's true.
Yes. So we want to be very specific there. And we'll see what else we have time to get to. So let's start off. Let's go right to Memphis TV, Barry. You ready for that?
I think we should.
June 19th, 1979. One of my all-time favorite tag teams that people just don't remember. And I'm not talking about that they were the Midnight Express or something like that, but just a fun act, okay? And that is the team of Wayne Ferris and Larry Latham, the Blonde Bombers. And they are taking on one of Barry's all-time favorites, Tony Charles, and a young, I mean really young, so young that they called him Tommy Gilbert Jr. He wasn't even Eddie yet. Barry, you had a chance to watch this. Is it a 15-minute draw or not quite?
So it is apparently, according to Lance, it is 2 seconds shy of a 15-minute,
which is
draw.
Absolutely brilliant. One of my favorite parts of the story. Yes,
and that's what he says. He goes, "Oh, he goes," and then he's questioning, "Was this a draw?" And he says, "No." He goes, "Tommy Gilbert Sr. jumped in the ring with 2 seconds left, so they're disqualified." This is a fun match, and it's and you're right too. The Blonde Bombers never really got the recognition that they deserved, and they were, I guess, essentially a short-lived tag team. We saw them in Florida. In 1979, they were maybe in Florida for 2 months. Great story about their exit from the state, and I'll save that for until a little bit later, Jeff. But we had them for 2 months. They were in Memphis. They were in Nashville. I don't know if they ever tagged anywhere else. I'm not that I'm aware of. And I got to say, Honky Tonk Man was never a wrestler that I ever enjoyed. For whatever reason, I never got into it. But I love him here in this role as Wayne Ferris. His partner, Larry Latham, everybody knows him as Moondog Spot. This is years before that beer gut. And he really, you talk about epic beer guts in professional wrestling. And certainly Moondog Spot has got to be right there. I would say Bull Belinsky, if you remember him. That's another one that just got to be right there for epic pot bellies and beer bellies. But they were a solid team. Tommy Gilbert Jr., this is Eddie Gilbert's, essentially, this is his rookie year. He had started off, I guess, some months earlier working independence in Malden, Missouri for a promoter named Henry Rogers. And made his way back down to Memphis. His real name was Thomas Edward Gilbert Jr., but he certainly adopted the Eddie Gilbert. But what's really interesting is, as you look at this, and Tony Charles, I fucking raved about this guy. He's fantastic. But you had three guys here. Take out Tony, who was the vet for sure. But you had three guys that went through complete gimmick changes in their career. Certainly, you know, you look at Tommy Gilbert here, Tommy Gilbert Jr., Eddie Gilbert, and he is a white meat babyface of the highest order. And, you know, literally within a couple of years, he would become hot stuff Eddie Gilbert, 3 or 4 years, actually. But complete change. Obviously, Larry Latham became a Moondog, you know, go figure. And then Wayne Ferris became Honky Tonk Man. So a little bit of a different look there, and his hair was darker, but this is a solid match. And this is not a match that you're going to watch that you're going to go, "Oh my God, I can't believe," you know, I would say the highlight of this are watching the drop kicks that Tony Charles throws. People that had seen his drop kicks will tell you it was the best in professional wrestling. I don't think it beats Sweet Brown Sugar, but I'll tell you, Tony, especially considering Tony was 5'7", maybe max. I mean, he was not a tall guy. He gets some serious, and those legs weren't long either. He gets some serious height with this, with his drop kick. So, this is a fun match. You know, listening to Lance is always good. And Lance was so perfect for Memphis. You know, that's one thing. You know, a guy like Gordon Solie just fit in so well in Florida. Jim Ross, UWF Mid South, and Lance in Memphis. But there's a portion where the ring falls off, or something falls off the ring, and he and Dave Brown, they start discussing it about, you know, part of the ring falling off. But good match, fun match. Again, there's nothing here that I think is life changing. But if you want a really good look at a territory from the 1970s, this is a fantastic look at it. And you're right, Jeff. Blonde Bomber should have been bigger. I don't know, you know, why they chose to go their separate ways. I don't know all the specifics with that. If we ever have a conversation with Honky Tonk Man, maybe that's a question we could ask him or should ask him. But fun match. Big, big, big thumbs up for me.
Yeah, essentially this match breaks into really two parts. The first 6, maybe 7 minutes of the match is Tony Charles just completely dominating the heels. He's doing all the British style of wrestling. He's completely baffled the heels. Tags into Eddie. You have about 1 or 2 minutes of Eddie doing stuff. And then basically the heels start working over the white meat babyface. And they pound him for a good 6 or 7 minutes. I think he makes finally the hot tag to Tony Charles. But then when he comes back in, they begin doubling him up. Dad, Tommy can't take it anymore. Jump, and like Barry said, literally at the 14:58 mark, Tommy just couldn't wait that extra 2 seconds to get his kid a draw. And so his kid ends up being on the losing end of the match. But you're right. You're 100% right, Barry. This is a really good look at Memphis in the late 70s, the territorial system. And it's a fun match. I mean, is this any kind of top 100 of the decade? No. But this is what Memphis was giving you, good TV matches. This undoubtedly would set something up at the arenas if they wanted to. It really introduced the Memphis folks to a young Eddie Gilbert, who was gonna. I know that he and his dad ended up getting into a program. I think we may have covered this match really early on with Ken and Buddy Wayne.
That's right.
Where they had a series that lasted a couple months with Ken and Buddy Wayne. So good stuff. We will post a link to this match on our Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry board. And I hope for those of you that are into the territorial wrestling, you'll give it a look-see. It's 15 minutes of your time, and I don't think it'll be time that's not well spent because it's a good match. So, Barry, now we're going to go somewhere. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. I did want to tell you the story of what happened with Latham and Ferris.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead. In Florida. So they were it was a weird kind of push. You were around for that time, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so it was a weird kind of push. They never rose above prelims, mid-card at best, but they were essentially first, second, and third match. And they weren't working with big-time teams like the Briscoes or Kern and Graham and stuff like that. They were more relegated, like having programs with Bubba Douglas and Gordon Nelson or Don Serrano. So it was pretty obvious that the office didn't have a lot of faith in them for whatever reason. Again, I think that's a mistake because I think these guys really had something going. And also interesting, because this wasn't so far off the time of Brian St. John and Stan Lane. And there are some similarities to the two teams. And I don't want to say that Lane and St. John were so much better workers, because they really weren't. But they had been in the territory, the Blonde Bombers, 6-7 weeks max. And they decided to, basically being jobbed out, they decided to give their notice to Eddie Graham. So they gave their notice, and I guess they're in their last week of their bookings, and they notice as they're looking at the bookings that they're working with Jack and Jerry Briscoe. So someone gets someone gets in the ear of these two guys, and they were essentially rookies. I don't know, you know, whether it's 1, 2, or 3 years in the business, but they weren't seasoned vets by any stretch. So they're in the ear of these guys. And basically telling them that that this is the way that you leave a territory. You're going to face two guys that are essentially shooters that have got all these skills. And Eddie's not really happy with you two guys right now, because he feels that you're arrogant. He feels you're cocky, that you've been shooting off your mouth, that you're going to another territory, which I think was going to be Memphis. And you're going to get a big push there because you haven't been used correctly here. So Eddie's really upset because he heard all of this. Have a good match against the Briscoe brothers. So they, I guess they get inside their own head, and as it turns out, they wind up packing their bags and no showing this match, and they left the state never to return for a single match ever again. gone from the state. So, you know, there were a few of these stories about, it with Eddie, because if you, you know, you didn't do what Eddie wanted, or if he felt that you had done something incorrectly, he felt that teaching you a lesson was the best way to handle a situation. So when I heard that, I really thought that was funny. And Honky Tonk Man has actually talked about that before.
So, you know, here's a topic that I just thought of. Teams that were in Florida that were, we know, good teams that never got the push that they might have gotten in other areas. Like, I know that the Sheep Herders, I'm not talking about their like 86, 87 run, but they were there, I want to say, in the early 70s or the early 80s, and they never got a huge push at that point. And I think John Boyd might have been with them then.
That's correct.
And there were teams like the Twin Devils, who were a main event act. And I understand they were kind of small, but they were like main eventing out in L.A. They came to Florida and they were never pushed above the mid card. Can you think of any more?
Gordman and Goliath. So, So Gorman and Goliath only had one match, which was in Miami Beach, and they wrestled Greg Valentine and Raul Mata, which is also interesting because it's two guys that they knew from the LA territory. But Twin Devils, I think that's a really good example right there. And Twin Devils, and this is what I think a lot of it boils down to as well. Twin Devils had everything going for them. They could work in the ring. The gimmick, you had two guys that were identical. You could not tell them apart. No mask or anything like that. You could have gone to the moon with this. But Eddie always had something against Mexican wrestlers, Lucha Libre wrestlers, Mexican wrestlers. He never pushed Mexican guys. Mil Mascaris doesn't count. He was a special attraction. But guys like Raul Mata came in. You know, Raul never got any respect. Gordman, Goliath, the list is long and it's endless. Twin Devils came in, and they actually did a little something with them. They worked with Jack Briscoe and Jimmy Garvin for the Florida tag team titles. But for the most part, Twin Devils didn't get any respect. Gordman, Goliath, we just talked about. But Eddie didn't like the Lucha guys. And it also appears that, and this part's really ironic, Eddie didn't have an affinity for Tennessee guys either. Being that Eddie was born and raised in Chattanooga and was a Tennessee guy, he certainly seemed to have no use for the Tennessee style of wrestling. So the guys like, you know, Latham and Ferris coming in, which really those were considered Tennessee guys, he gave nothing to. You know, Jerry Lawler, I think, was a different story. Jerry got that push. You know, you were there for that in the early 80s, but it wasn't this main event push. And Jerry really wasn't the right fit for the state of Florida either. But, you know, he just, you know, here's a good example of exactly what I'm talking about. And this falls into what you're talking about, the Mass Superstars in 1975. So you had Jerry Lawler and Don Green with Sam Bass. Sam Bass, an incredible, incredible manager. They came in and they gave him a push. You know, again, mid-card at best. This was not a main event push. They feuded with Cyclone and Omar Negro for the Florida tag team titles. But these guys should have held the titles. They should have had bigger, stronger programs. And for whatever reason, Eddie always looked at Memphis style of wrestling, I think, as gimmicky and never did much with them. So that's an excellent question, though. And I really like that because I think if you look at the teams that he didn't like, they were either Hispanic, generally Mexican, or they were coming from the Memphis or Nashville region.
So how do you explain the Sheepherders not getting the push in the 81-ish, especially because 81 was kind of a downtime in the territory, and John Boy was just, he was lightning in a bottle on the microphone, you know, and he could create something out of nothing. It worked in Southwest, it worked in Portland, worked in Tennessee, and maybe that's the Tennessee stigma. I don't know. I mean, can you think of a reason why he wouldn't have pushed the Sheepherders then?
A logical reason? Absolutely not. So there is, it makes, and you're right too, because it was to some degree, it was a downtime. But they were actually having good matches. They were working with the Briscoe brothers. They were working with Coco Samoa. I think Sweet Brown Sugar was in, and their matches, especially when you had Boyd around, they were bloodbaths. You know, they were absolutely bloodbaths. So it doesn't make any sense. But again, you may have that Tennessee stigma attached to it that just seemed to, you know, turn him off. And Jonathan Boyd, Jonathan Boyd's promos were gold. There's a guy that's almost forgotten in history, I think, in professional wrestling history. His promos were just through the roof.
And they were, you know, what's great about them? They weren't smart ass promos. Like I was watching some stuff the other day with Roddy Piper, who's one of the all time great interviews and promo guys, but he always has that kind of like little smirk. John Boyd was just free. He was like Jody Hamilton. He was just evil.
Yes. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
And, just tremendous stuff. All right. So now let's go to an area that we, quite frankly, I don't think have ever brought up here on this show, but something happened within the last couple of weeks that I actually told the story to Brian last, and Brian, after I told him the story, said, "You have to talk about this story in your podcast because it's just so fascinating." So Barry, have I discussed with you my former boss at the Clerk of Courts, Brenda D. Foreman?
You have. Yes, okay. You have.
This is a pretty fascinating story, folks. Brenda D. Foreman is the current elected clerk of the county and circuit court in Broward County, Florida, Fort Lauderdale. Okay. When I retired last August, she was the clerk of court. She is running now for re-election. She has two former judges running against her. The election is to be held, I want to say, within the next 3 to 4 weeks. Broward County is a real Democratic stronghold. So everybody that runs in Broward pretty much runs, especially in a nonpartisan, quote unquote, nonpartisan race, runs on the Democratic ticket because, if you're a Republican, you have like no chance of ever getting elected in Broward County. So she's running against two judges, one whose name is Paul Backman. The other one's name is Mark Spicer. They're both retired judges. I know both of them personally also. Let me give you a little background on Brenda D. Foreman because it's a pretty fascinating story. I was an in-court clerk. Okay, so at the clerk's office, if you're not in management, being an in-court clerk is pretty much top of the pay scale. Now I say that a bit tongue-in-cheek because I didn't get a pay raise the last 12 years I was there, but that's another story for another time. But she worked as a what they call a docket clerk. She prepared the criminal dockets for the judges. She would get the files together. She would, pull the files, give them to the clerk to get ready for court. And it's another job within the system, but it's a job that I know pays a little bit less money. Okay. So the gentleman at the time who was the clerk of court, who had been the clerk of court for going on 16 years, was a man whose name was Howard C. Foreman. Howard C. Foreman was a former Florida state legislator, a guy that's been in politics for probably close to 40 years. Howard C. Foreman was married to his wife for, I want to say, over maybe 40 years. His wife, I believe, dies of cancer. Okay. So Howard Foreman, of course, is moving on with his life, meets this woman who's one of his employees, and he begins dating her. Like, kind of, Barry, when a husband or wife dies, there's always that perceived timeline as to when it's okay for the person to begin putting the line in the water. Fair way of putting it.
Yeah, Jeff, you're 100% right. People feel that there has got to be this period of mourning, and everybody seems to have their own rules when it comes to it. Is it 6 months? Is it a year? Is it 2 years? Is it forever? There are people that, it's crazy that look at it that way. It's none of our fucking business, right?
No, but, again, there is societal decorum, if you will.
Wow, look at you, Paul.
Yeah, I'm throwing out the good verbiage here. Yeah. But at some point, I want to say it was within about a year, he kind of stuns everybody by marrying this line employee of his, okay? Now, after 16 years as the elected clerk of courts in Broward County, Florida, Howard Foreman, who at this point is like, got to be in his mid-70s, decides it's time for him to retire. So he retires, and of course, there are people, because the clerk's office, you're overseeing about 700 or 800 people, but it's a job that pays relatively well, because I want to say you're making somewhere in the neighborhood of $175,000 to $200,000, okay? And so, yeah, it's a nice hunk of change. So he retires, and I know among the people that put in for it was the woman who was basically the business administrator for the public defender's office. And then we had the head of the Democratic Broward, I think the Broward County Democratic Club. Okay. A guy with lots of political stroke. That's one of these guys. If you want to get elected, you call this guy. So there are two pretty formidable names. Well, then Brenda Foreman puts her name in. Okay. Again, someone who's only experience in this clerk's, she worked as a line employee for like 2 years. Okay. And so, somewhat shockingly, Brenda Foreman wins the election. Now, some people would have you believe that when, you go into an election, and let's be real candid, Barry, if you go in to vote and your local elections, they're an Ambler, chances are, the people running for, city council or, some of your courthouse, the people running for judges, you really don't know the names. And so you sit there and you go in and you're like, yeah, I think I remember that name. Click that name. Or, you know, oh, I saw that guy. He got indicted. Yeah, I want to make sure. You know, I mean, the people that whose name is out there in a negative way, a lot of times you don't want to vote for them, right?
Sure.
So, of course, the name Howard Foreman, having been in Broward County and in Broward County elections for the better part of over 30 years, it's a name people recognize. So shockingly, she wins the election, okay? And she becomes the clerk of courts. So let's talk about, a couple months after the election, I want to say 2 or 3 months after the election, she tries to have her husband declared mentally incompetent. Okay.
Wow.
Divorce proceedings ensue. Okay. He is found to be not mentally incompetent, which I already knew, but it was like one of these things where it was a pretty shocking allegation, needless to say. Then along the way, she and I will say, before I get into some of the other allegations against her, any personal contact that I've had with her has never been negative. For whatever reason, she liked me. Okay. I'm a charming guy. Let's be candid. And so she was always very, you know, hey, Jeff, how you doing? I actually did some work, voiceover work for the clerk's office when you would call, you know, you call in to find out when you got a report for jury duty. That was my voice. You've reached the Broward County Clerk of Courts, because let's be honest, I got a podcast. I got a hell of a voice. Let's be honest, Barry. And so so that's how she knew me. And so I will just quantify it by saying I have no, you know, I had no personal issue with her. But just some of the stuff that came up was pretty fascinating, Barry. So there's a lawyer in the courthouse that has a blog. OK, and it's he's had it now for the better part of 10 years, if not a little bit longer. And he's sort of like a gadfly around the courthouse. Anything, you know, a judge, we've over the last, 15 to 20 years, I think there's been something like 10 judges that have gotten popped for DUIs. It's who knows why. It's just like one of these little anomalies. And so Broward County doesn't have the greatest reputation among the, you know, the people, the judiciary of the state of Florida. So this lawyer is always after like little stories and stuff like that. Well, so one day he's in the courthouse waiting for an elevator, and she comes walking up with one of her assistants, and he makes a comment to her and he says, "Oh, good morning, Brenda. How you doing?" He refers to her as Brenda. Okay. Now this is somebody that he's met before. Okay. Brenda turns to her assistant, says something, and the assistant says, "Mrs. Foreman would wish that you would address her as either Mrs. Foreman or Madam Clerk." Huh. She doesn't want to personalize Brenda. Okay. So this starts what can only be described as a feud between this lawyer with the blog and Brenda D. Foreman that continues to this day. Okay. She tried to get this guy disbarred. She filed a restraining order against him. And then he, of course, to play tit for tat, began trying to get photos of her. He would like walk around the courthouse, take out his phone and try to take photos of her. And she would, you know, sit there and hold her phone up. And it was like a couple of middle schoolers going back and forth. Okay. So fast forward to this year, it's an election year. She goes on Facebook, posts a 40-minute. Now, mind you, everyone I've talked to says that despite the fact that she has two judges, men that you would think have relatively good reputations in the community. But again, let's remember, Barry, you don't know the local elections. Most people don't know some of these names, right? So most people that I've talked to that know anything about local politics in Broward County have said that she's basically got this election in the bag, okay? All she has to do is sit back and not say anything, okay? She then posted a 40-minute video on Facebook, which she discussed her campaign, perceptions of her. She described herself as the most hated woman of color in Broward County, her battle with COVID because she allegedly had contracted COVID, okay, and was out for a couple of weeks. She said while she was in the hospital, she had conversations with God, quote, God literally gave me the names of judges, attorneys, laymen. These are people in the community who are doing unrightful and ungodly things. She also said she'd been treated unfairly, as I said, as the most hated woman in of color in Broward County. To say that this video was a little bit out there, because she said that God, she was on the floor in the hospital, and God picked her up, put her back in the bed, and said, "You've still got work to do." That was a little on the weird side, Barry.
Yeah, just a little.
But it gets better.
No.
Yes. Amongst other things, she agreed to resolve a state ethics investigation by admitting that she misstated her financial status for four straight years, starting as a candidate for clerk, and agreed to pay a $5,000. So she had to go in front of the state ethics commission, okay? And she basically admitted guilt, and then she had to pay the fine. Now, you would think that's enough. Oh, no, wait, there's more. This is the final little coup de grace here, Barry. You know, Barry, when you're running for office and you want to come up with an inspiring quote, you want to have something that's going to really rally the troops around you, something that's going to make the people, you know, a quote from a famous person that people are going to go, yeah, this is somebody that I want to vote for. Who's the one person in world history that you don't want to use to get or you don't want to have a quote from?
Well, I already know the answer to this one.
Okay.
Jeff,
so. Yeah, the answer to that question is Adolf Hitler.
Okay. Right.
I could have gone maybe, you know, a couple other world leaders that haven't been such, yeah. You know, maybe Gaddafi or you know, Saddam Hussein. But anyway, Adolf Hitler, she quotes, she has a picture that looks like Hitler. It's not Hitler, but it's somebody that looks like Hitler. And she has a quote from Hitler. And I don't even remember. The funny thing was the quote was actually not from Hitler. It was somebody else, but she attributed it to Hitler.
Yes.
Well, okay. As you might imagine, this upset a few people in Broward County. I know that's a stunning development to you, Barry. Okay. Yeah. So she then is approached by one of the local news stations to ask her to explain herself. She somehow tries to justify what she did. You know, oh, it was a misunderstanding, but she doesn't apologize. Okay. Following that, about 2 days later, she has another interview with the same TV station where she actually apologizes for using the image of Hitler and falsely attributing a quote to him. Barry, this woman is up for election in a couple weeks. And yet, after all this, there are people out there that will tell you that she's still going to get reelected. Oh, and by the way, one last little tidbit. She is the only office in the Broward County Courthouse that has employees coming to work. The public defender's office, the state attorney's office, the Broward Sheriff's Office, of course, they assign court deputies or, you know, they call them bailiffs. They don't have their people coming to work because of this pandemic. Brenda Foreman has people coming to work during this pandemic. Anyway, Barry, it's a crazy story. We don't usually talk politics, but this was such a juicy story. I felt like I had to share it with the people.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's political in nature, but at the same time, this isn't an indictment of a political party or anything like that. So, but Jeff, so here's the crazy part. Taking out everything that we just said and just laying it down as base as we can possibly do it, how in God's name, and I remember the photo you sent me, it certainly looked like it was a photo of Hitler. If not, it was a great impersonator, but it looked like a photo of Hitler in the photo with the quote attributed to him, even though he didn't actually say it. But for her to show such a lack of common sense in posting something, somebody who is for anyone to do it, but let alone somebody running for an office, is it's imaginable. And the fact that she still could win is maybe even more frightening at this stage. How do you show such a lack of a million things, lack of empathy, but a lack of common sense in posting something like that? How fucking out to lunch are you, Brenda?
Well, and, you know, quite frankly, there have been people that have called for the governor to remove her from office. Okay, it's not a huge outcry, but there have been voices that have said that this is somebody that the governor should remove. Couple problems with that. She's a Democrat. The governor is Republican. Okay. Right. So if he does that, there's going to be a huge outcry saying it's all, you know, Republican versus Democrat. And I don't want to get into that. As you know, Broward County is well known, somewhat notorious, if you will, for the problems that they've had over the last 20 years or so with elections, with the ballots coming in late or not being marked. And the governor, I don't know if it was the current governor or the prior governor that removed a Democrat who had been elected as the supervisor of elections, removed her from office. So that would make two Democratic women that would have been removed from office, I want to say, by Republican governors. So that would be, just a huge outcry. So I don't know if he wants to deal with that political softball or problem that would ensue from. Yeah, but this is just a crazy story that I can't believe it almost hasn't gone national just because of how outrageous some of her conduct has been. And I'm going to be very curious. I'll be watching the elections in Broward County. I actually have some people that are friends of mine that are running for office for a public defender and for a state attorney. And so I'm going to be watching the elections. But this is just a crazy story, Barry. I will keep the folks updated on what happens. And if she manages to do anything as I don't know, stupid or egregious as this before the election, because I quite frankly, I have to wonder if she's going to be able to resist just getting out there and doing something on social media again. So Barry, now let's turn to something that popped up on YouTube, I want to say within the last 3 or 4 weeks. And when I saw this, I went, wow, this must be, and I started watching it. It is called 1972, A Night at the Coliseum. And wow, Barry, I can't recommend this video enough. This is a behind the scenes look at promoter Paul Bosch and the workings of Houston wrestling. But what's great about it, Barry, is you are actually taken in the ring. Wow. Who do we have now? Of course, I'm drawing a complete blank. But who was in the main event with Johnny Valentine?
Stan Crusher Stasiak.
That's right. Who actually looked pretty good. Because
looked
I gotta
great.
Be- I got to be honest with you. I've seen Stan Stasiak only from some of the late 70s WWF stuff where he didn't look very good, but he was much thicker in the chest in this, and he and Johnny Valentine have a war. You don't see the entire match, but there's a good 5 to 7 minutes of these two guys beating the living hell out of one another. I know John Hitchcock is going to love this because he is a Johnny V fan from way back. And Hitch, you got to watch this video. Barry, tell us what you thought of it.
This is the greatest 34 minutes of professional wrestling I probably have seen over the last several years. This is everything that you would dream as a territory wrestling fan. The only complaint I will have with this is that it isn't 5 times longer than it is. But I would also dream that every other territory would have something produced like this. And so it's really a breakdown. It's several different things. There is in-ring action. They cover 4 matches. They interview a lot of the ringside fans, which is to me is really key to this because these people are beyond interesting. And they also go to Paul Bosch's office. I think it was 1919 Caroline, if I remember the
Absolutely.
Address.
Absolutely. That was the address.
So they actually go to his office and he does an interview from his office and they actually give you a tour of the office. This is wrestling history. First off, where did this come from? Why is this just making the rounds?
I have no idea.
48 years later, Jeff, we've never seen this. I never knew this existed. It's brand new to YouTube. This is absolutely incredible. So they show 4 matches. The opening match, Nick Kozak, who was a great guest on our show about a year and a half ago, and Dean Ho, the Happy Hawaiian, versus Mr. Fuji. Yes, that Mr. Fuji. And Gypsy Joe Rosario. First off, Nick Kozak's punches, they look amazing. Gypsy Joe Rosario, how is this guy not a bigger star?
Facials on this guy were amazing.
And the weird body movement. And then
he had kind of a cross between hippie Mike Boyette
and
Snake Brown.
That's exactly who he was. He was another version. But then you've got this large African-American woman at ringside who starts mimicking him with the same motions. This is fucking gold right here. The next match, I mean, this is a dream. You've got Terry and Dory Funk Sr. versus Wild Bill Curry, who's, I think, 80 in this match, and Paul Bosch. Fucking Paul Bosch, the promoter. This is great. Paul Bosch, I don't know how old. He had to be 60 here, right? if not even older than 60, but he's taking bumps. He takes a bump. Incredible. Next match, Thunderbolt Patterson versus Red Bastine for the Texas title. Thunderbolt looks amazing here. And Jeff, this is somebody maybe we should think about as getting a guest on the show. Thunderbolt, because interesting guy, obviously, but I saw Thunderbolt, I guess I saw him right around this time, but I don't remember a lot, but I saw him in 76, and I can tell you he wasn't the same guy. He had slowed down tremendously, but he looks fantastic. And then the main event, as you mentioned, Johnny Valentine versus Stan Stasiak. And how do they set this up? Valentine, generally a heel, but he's a baby face because I guess he's come out and he's made the save, but Stan Stasiak had heart punched 2,000-year-old Danny McShane, I guess, a week earlier. It gave him the heart punch. Danny McShane goes down.
Now, let's preface this for those that don't know. Danny McShane was a huge, huge star in Houston wrestling in the 50s and into the 60s. And then he transitioned into becoming a referee.
And to that point as well, Bull Curry was another guy that was probably going back to the late 40s or early 50s in Texas. And here he is in 1972. He's still drawing money. You can see it, which is absolutely incredible. But yeah, you're right. It's Danny McShane was an absolutely huge star. He was a heel. I believe he may have at some point switched over to babyface. I'm not really sure about that. But as a referee, he was your preeminent referee. And he actually looks pretty good right here because he takes the hard punch and he sells it. And then right before the match of Valentine and Stasiak, Stasiak spends about a minute just ripping the clothes off of Danny McShane as Valentine stands off to the corner and watches. And I'm like, Johnny, come on, jump in, man. You got to jump in here. The key to all this, what I really love, Stan Stasiak, along with Paul Bosch, gives an interview. And the interview is he's got a large poster of human anatomy, of the heart and the entire body. And he's explaining what happens to the arteries when he punches you in the chest. And
yeah, it was absolutely brilliant.
It's the greatest fucking 2 minutes in the history of a video because he has clearly no idea what he's talking about. And it's fucking cool.
That he's never stopped wrestlers before.
That's what makes it so great is that he's like, because you got to remember, too, in 1972, Jeff, he's like, this fucking thing is going to air once. Nobody will ever see it. I could say whatever I want. You know, who's ever thinking about, you know, that everybody in the world will be able to see this 48 years later? But he's talking about, if I hit you here, this constricts the blood flow and then the air flow. And he says the word, which you know is a key bullshit word. He says, therefore, like 20 times. There, which he does. He keeps going, therefore, which you just know he's so fucking full of shit. This is, go out of your way. I am telling you, this is the greatest thing I may have ever seen. I could not have loved this video anymore. I am going to go back and rewatch it because it's that good. The other key to this is the interviews of the fans.
Oh my God. Let's just say there is one that is, in hindsight, is extremely troubling.
are we talking about the attempted rape story?
Yes.
And we don't mean to laugh, but so this woman, the first interview is a woman and her son who does some sort of Scott Steiner math about moving to Texas and moving back to Ohio and then back to Texas. And if you listen to her, somehow this would have occurred over like a 30-year period, though the kid looks about 12. So I couldn't figure out, but she basically said all the wrestlers in Ohio are sissies. But we left Ohio 12 years ago and we came. I couldn't understand it, but she was great. Then you've got these two fucking smoking women or girls. I mean, I don't know how old, 18, 20. They're really attractive. They come to wrestling to see the wrestlers, which clearly, because the wrestlers are really nice to them. Go get
and then sign out autographs and talk with us.
Go there, and the one's breasts are basically out, and exactly, and it's just, and they're really friendly to us. It's like, of course they are. This is the, I'm telling you, this is great. But then we get on to the next one, and it's really bizarre because you've got a woman who,
first of all, I have trouble wondering and realizing why they included this particular clip in the movie. You know? Because it's just so completely out of context. Completely. You know, go ahead. I'm sorry, but it's just bizarre.
And we clearly want to stress, that this is not, we're not making fun of an attempted rape. We're really, because this has no placement in this film, because she starts off and she comes off as maybe a little more bright, a little more educated than some of the other people that have been interviewed. She's also dressed extremely well. She's wearing this really fucking stylish dress, though she is wearing sunglasses, and she starts to tell a story about how much she loves wrestling and how she got into it. Her husband got free. She didn't call him tickets. She called him a bizarre word for tickets that I forget what it was. But then she gets out of nowhere. She talks about how she was home waiting for her husband, and then a large African-American man broke in and like threw her on the bed and started to undo his trousers. But then she somehow remembers the moves that she's seen in wrestling and is able to successfully fight this guy off. But it's really bizarre, the placement of it in there. Would you'd have to agree with that?
Oh, extremely odd. Right. You know, and the thing is the reason it's in there was she talked about how she remembered all the holds from wrestling and she put him in a headlock. and that's how she ends up fighting him off. Yeah. Was remembering the holes that she had seen on Houston wrestling, and we haven't even discussed the guy with no teeth.
Oh, he's the best. And then at the end, because they've got him in. He's so good. He's in two segments. And at the end, he looks and he goes, "Well, you know," he goes, "Can I say this on here?" And they're like, "Yeah." And he goes, "That guy's a son of a bitch." You know, it was just so good. He's great, the guy. And this was the same guy. Pardon me. He talks nothing like a good burp, but I know I got a shit story coming up. So exactly.
We had to balance out, you know,
we had to balance out a little bit. So he starts talking about how he knows the heart punch is real. And the interviewer asks him, "So did Crusher Stasiak ever hit you with the heart punch?" "No, it wasn't him, but I know it's real. I know it's real. I've been hit by somebody else." So there's other people going around Houston just fucking laying in the heart punch, which I like.
Yeah, we can't. We'll post a link to this this YouTube video also on our message board at Breaking Kayfabe with Boundary. This is absolute gold.
Oh no, this is fucking platinum, Jeff.
This is the highest level. If all you saw was the wrestling, would be worth it. If all yes. you saw was the interviews with the people at ringside, that would be worth it. The fact that they're both in there, Barry's right. This is a platinum. video that must be seen, and I can't recommend it strongly enough. It is so much fun to watch. Okay, Barry, now it's time for the shitty part of our episode. So let me just give a little preamble to this. So as I said, a couple nights ago, my wife is looking at something, I don't know, on Facebook or Google, and she just starts busting out laughing. She says, "I have to read this to you." She reads a story to me about gastrointestinal effects that sugarless gummy bears have on certain people. So I texted Barry. I said, "Hey, did you ever hear about this?" And Barry said, "Hear about it. I have a story for the podcast." So Barry, before I share some of the, and we're going to go back to something we haven't done in a long time, is the Breaking Kayfabe Theater, folks. So Barry, tell us your sugarless gummy bear story.
Yeah, absolutely, too. So this is, unfortunately, I never made it to a lawn for this one, but this was pretty tough. So this is going to go back, this would be 2003, I believe. It's either 2003 or early 2004. And I was working in New York City, managing a restaurant on the Upper East Side, but we had actually left New York City because of 9/11 and all that had occurred. It was a tough place to live right after 9/11. So we had moved out to the suburbs of New Jersey, and we were living in a town called South Orange, New Jersey. Train ride from New York City was about 35 minutes. So it wasn't terrible by any stretch. So I was managing this restaurant, and this restaurant was on the second floor of a gigantic warehouse. And the first floor was a retail store. And it was everything. It's breads, meats, seafoods, desserts, you know, beverages. It literally was a high-end retail store and massive, but they also had a big candy department. So we had the autonomy where we could go down and basically take whatever we wanted. And a lot of times I would go down and get products and bring it up to the restaurant and we could do certain specials. So I went down one day and they had gummy bears in bags. And what they would do, as a lot of places do, they would get the shit in bulk, you know, 20, 30, 50 pounds, and then they would portion it out and they would sell smaller bags of it, like the big places that do it with the bins. So I grabbed a thing of gummy bears. I've always loved gummy candy, still do to this day, surprised I have any teeth. And I bring it upstairs and I start to eat them. And taste wise, I didn't notice anything. They were real. They tasted fine. I had no issue. So I ate the entire bag, and it was probably a pound of gummy bears, which is a lot, you know, sugar free or not sugar free. That's a lot of fucking gummy bears. So within about a half an hour of eating them, there is a rumbling in my stomach. And as anybody that's ever experienced some sort of gastrointestinal discomfort, you know this rumbling because you can hear it, you feel it, and you just know something clearly isn't right with this. So I hear the rumbling. I'm, you know, I want to think, okay, you know, I'll be fine. I go to the bathroom and I'll let that go for the moment. But I come out and I'm like, fuck, man, that was a little frightening. So I'm out and we're starting to close up. It's the end of the day. I'm hitting the bathroom again. So this is where this story will get a little uglier. So with that retail shopping, I used to do the retail shopping for our house, meats and things like that, on the Sundays that I worked. So I had gotten probably $50, $60 of steak or chicken, whatever it is. And I'm getting ready. I got a discount, which is the reason I did it. And I'm getting ready to take it home. But I have to go to Penn Station to take the train back to New Jersey. So somebody actually drove me to Penn Station. Somebody had a car, one of my waiters, and I make it to Penn Station and I know I'm in trouble right away. Like I could feel it. So I'm doing that walk. You know that walk when you're
I'm familiar right. with that walk.
So it's an aggressive walk, but yet your legs don't separate too much because you're afraid if they do, you're gonna go. So I get in and I run to the bathroom. Now, Jeff,
the Penn Station bathroom. I'm guessing you already is got very it. Clean.
So there you go. Yes, so you've already you without ever being in that bathroom, Jeff. You already understand So when you walk in, it's also an encampment for the homeless because it's where they bathe. They bathe in the sinks. So so I had to go to a toilet. So I open up the door to a stall and realize. I have two options here. One is I could sit on this toilet or get as close as possible to it, or I can shit myself, but then I got to get on a train to go to New Jersey. So I sit down and we're talking mega bomb explosions are occurring. This is massive. This is this is nothing that is of a regular nature. And I'm doing my best to not actually sit on the toilet for the obvious reason. At the same time, I've got a bag of $50, $60 worth of meat in my hands. So this is just the fucking worst possible. So I get on the train, and of course I'm doing the praying right now that just get me home. I have two bathrooms in our apartment in South Orange. You know, beautiful bathroom, spacious. Just get me home. And about
ply toilet paper.
Yeah. All you need. I got a shower. I could get right in the shit. So it's lovely. Within 10 minutes, it starts. And I am squeezing and pinching to the point that I had never been like that before. And I'm sweating profusely. It is another 20 to 25 minutes until we're at South Orange. Then I've got the walk from the train station to the house. So I conceivably was about 30 minutes total, the worst 30 minutes of my life. I'm sweating. I'm in pain. I know that if I sneezed, I'm shitting my pants. And it was brutal. I get in the house, the apartment. I push open the door. Zach is 2 years old. So he's excited to see his dad who's coming home. My wife's there, open arms. I literally push them both out of the way. I run to the toilet and I sit down and all you hear is boom. It's a massive fucking boom. My wife, and I think I did shut the door. She certainly shut the door if I didn't. So she's talking to me outside the door and she's saying, what's going on? And I explain the situation, what went down. I clean, I get in the shower, but I also notice I've hit the door in the bathroom. The door from the commode, Jeff, was a solid 6 to 7 feet. That is,
and hit the shower door?
No, I hit the door to the bathroom that would lead out into the apartment.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how in God's name.
A little backsplash there or what?
I don't think a little backsplash. I think we're talking like fucking record backsplash. So this all was because, and I left this part out. I was like, why is my stomach so fucked up? And then I saw that these were sugar-free gummy bears. Without knowing, there was a disclaimer that you should limit your intake because it has been known to cause stomach discomfort. Let me tell you, it is massive. It will clean you out and clear you out like no one else's business.
Anyone with constipation issues
can
help resolve this situation. So, Barry, I have gone to Google and pulled up the Google reviews, and now a reading from the Breaking Kayfabe Theater. This comes from Jimmy Beans and was posted on October 17th, 2015. A delicious treat that should be enjoyed only after the following preparations have been made. Number one, make sure it's Friday and cancel all weekend plans. For good measure, go ahead and call in for Monday. Number two, call the city and make sure your water bill is paid in full. Number three, visit your local hardware store and purchase a sink attachment for your garden hose, as toilet paper will quickly become too painful to bear. Four, give advance notice to family members, roommates, and neighbors, unless you're keen on trying to give birth to a crushed watermelon while convincing your local SWAT team that the screaming and demonic noises are for you. A dynamic entry would only bring about more needless suffering. Oh, that's good.
Oh, fuck.
Number five, he's not done. Number five, redo your restroom in motivational pictures. One with slogans like courage is fear, hanging on 1 minute longer. The only easy day was yesterday, etc. I also advise posting up the suicide prevention hotline number or having a dedicated friend or other support group to walk you through the low times. Oh, Jimmy Beans.
Yeah, and I got to say—
Wait a minute, not quite done. Lastly, I must strongly urge you to consider why you are thinking about buying this product. Is it a keen sense of deep self-loathing? A reckless sense of adventure? Are you researching this? Are you researching dysentery? Perhaps you are the drill sergeant of some extreme commando unit seeking to break down the enemy's will.
Oh,
to fight by airdropping these into their midst. If you are just curious, then let me say, oh, fellow humans, beware, for this life is dangerous enough. Next time I want a thrill, I'll skydive without a parachute. That way, at least I'll have a chance. Oh, Jimmy Beans, that's a good one. Okay, what were you going to say, Barry?
Oh, those are all stellar too, and they're all right on the money. That's the best part. There is how many people do you think unsuspectingly eat these fucking things every year and experience this? Why is this on the market? Like, why in God's name is this still on the market?
Yeah. Let's see. I'm just going to read a couple more real quick from Saleya. The title is Smells Like Hell. This was the day my life changed. I bought a bag of these delicious Satan snacks, and they took me back to the past. They took me back to the day Pompeii erupted. Instead of lava, there was a hot brown liquid feces exploding out of what could be the black pit of hell. I was sitting on the toilet, sweaty as fuck. It felt like I was in a sauna after drinking veggie-free kombucha while being punched in the gut by Arnold Schwarzenegger. The worst part was I didn't have any toilet paper. I questioned myself if I should use my dog to while my sweaty crack of hell, but I'd rather shoot him before I put him through the hell like that. All in all, 10 out of 10, great gift, would buy again. Oh, man.
These people have a sense of humor, though. I love that. I think that
Jordan posted diapers needed. It's the last one I'll read, Barry.
Sure.
I was waiting in the Walmart checkout line and looked to my left to find a pleasant surprise, a pack of Haribo gummy bears somebody had dropped off and decided not to get. After trying to eat healthy for weeks, it was a sign I needed these gummy bears. They needed me. So I decided to get them and eat the whole bag right before bed, of course. A few hours later, I woke up in the middle of the night because the bed was wet. I quickly realized I was the cause of the spill. I rushed to the bathroom and the fire hose exploded, gushing for minutes. I cleaned up the mess, went back to bed, only for this unpleasant exposure to happen two more times during the night. On my third date with the throne around 5:30 a.m., a thought exploded in my brain almost as intense as my bottom half that night. Those gummy bears must have been sugar-free. After cleaning everything up and onto our last set of sheets, I rummaged through the trash and found, indeed, the whole bag of gummy bears I had eaten were sugar-free. The reviews are true. If you need a good clean-out, this product is for you.
Jeff, so what's interesting, have you ever had constipation?
I have been a victim of said malady. I have not taken to the gummy bears to help that problem.
Yeah, so there was a period, I want to say it was 1990, maybe 1991, and pardon me, I didn't go for a week. And I remember waking up at like 4 a.m. with the worst headache, just feeling terrible. And I remember going to you remember Pantry Pride?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I wound up going to a Pantry Pride at like 4 a.m. in the morning to get something to help me and to clear me out. But I agree. If you're ever backed up, sugar-free gummy bears are the way to go. 100%.
Forget that, like Miralax and stuff like that. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
But folks, I can just hardly recommend you stay away from the sugar-free gummy. Hey, I don't know, Barry, do you like the regular gummy bears?
I'm a huge Jeff. I do like Haribo, and there's the trolley ones are really good. But something I discovered the last couple of years are the gummy lifesavers that are just fantastic. So it's my go-to now.
I have never eaten gummy bears. I just, something about, even before the cancer, the whole texture of eating that is just, it seems very weird to me. And now certainly I will avoid it. So Barry, now we've reached the point in the show. It is time to discuss our top five opening scenes to movies. Again, these are not the best of all time. It's just our own personal choice. So Barry, let's give an example of what we're talking about. What is your number five?
My number five is a movie that you are also interested in. It's Halloween, the original Halloween, 1978, directed by the great John Carpenter. And so what we're looking for with this is essentially just the opening scene of a movie. What opening scene of a movie had you hooked, grabs you by the balls, and has got you? And Halloween, because this wasn't the first movie to ever do it, but it was the first movie I think that had such a huge audience for it. And this was the opening scene of Halloween essentially is where Michael Myers, it's a point of view where he's killing his sister. And it's only after the fact do we discover that it's a little boy in a costume that's just killed his sister. The whole time you're watching this guy with a knife going to kill his sister and the boyfriend or whatever. So you know, again, after the fact, we see it. But, you know, now you see point of view. Certainly it's done on television a lot, but and movies do it. And there was a couple of movies prior that had done this. But this movie was such a big deal. And still to this day, 42 years later, it's a huge deal. First movie I ever recall with the point of view. But it was really impactful because it was so unique. It was super impactful on me. So, my number five, Jeff, the original Halloween.
Yeah, one of the great horror films of all time, in my estimation. Certainly, Jamie Lee Curtis has made a career just out of this franchise. I think they had one come out last year.
Yeah,
she and her brother are still going at it, and quite frankly, most of the follow-ups or the sequels have not been anywhere near the original. But the original is that's a must-watch come Halloween season as Michael Myers chases after Laurie Strode.
Laurie Strode.
And it's always good. And of course, iconic music. You know, just will send chills down your spine when you first hear it. My number five, Barry, is the opening scene to 1981 Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark, where we are first introduced to Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford's iconic movie character. And, you know, I heard they're in production of another one. Good Lord. Harrison Ford's like 75 years old now.
At least.
Yeah. And but this, of course, is the opening scene where he and the young guide are going into the cave to try to recover the artifact that is all booby trapped. And then, of course, once he gets the artifact and his guide has been killed, as Indiana Jones begins to leave the cave, the giant boulder comes rolling down and he's being chased through spider webs and such like that as the boulder appears to, you know, come towards him. And you think the boulder is about to crush him. A great, great opening scene, Barry.
This is not my favorite movie of all time. I love the movie, though, but it's not, you know, but at the end of the day, I think this is probably the greatest opening of any movie ever. It's such a this is the kind of thing that when that scene ended, you knew that you were going to be in for something really special. And I remember the first time I saw this movie at the 163rd Street Shopping Center with a group of friends. And I remember walking out saying, this is my favorite movie of all time right now, because I was blown away. But that opening sequence, my God, was that absolutely incredible. Just loved it.
Yeah. Okay, you're number four.
My number four is The Lion King. So we're talking the animated version of The Lion King, not the remake that I think came out last year, which was live action, if I'm correct. I never saw it. But The Lion King is arguably my favorite Disney movie ever. And a lot of it is, and not to get too, you know, maudlin, but my father passed away about 3 or 4 months before this movie was released. And this movie is essentially about a son trying to live up to maybe his father's expectations or, you know, along those lines. So this was a very heartfelt type of movie for me. At the same time, that opening sequence as they introduce Simba and his father is on the cliff and is holding him above his head, which has been recreated now a million times in a lot of different comedy sketches and things like that. But, you know, you've got great music. You've got the Elton John music, and then you've got all the animals, you know, going to this location so they can meet the new king. I just think it's such a beautiful, amazing scene that every time I see it, and I must have seen this movie 100 times, I still get goosebumps when I see it.
Yeah, it's definitely a movie that is a story that can be enjoyed not only by kids, but by adults also, you know. And this was when Disney was really hitting their stride with some of their animated movies. They definitely had a resurgence that started, I want to say, in the late 80s. During the 70s and the early 80s, Disney, they weren't putting out a lot of really good movies, and they certainly weren't putting out a lot of good animated movies. But with this and some of the other movies that came out around that time, they really hit their stride and were really doing well. And yeah, this is, you know, there's drama. There's humor with the meerkat and the a warthog?
Those two
characters that they provide the humor and stuff like that. There's, of course, the tragedy with his father. And then, of course, there's the end where he comes and faces his Uncle Scar. And it's a movie I can't recommend enough, Barry. It's a really, really great movie. So my number four, Barry, I have stated on more than one occasion here that my favorite Bond of all time was Sean Connery, probably with Daniel Craig being second. My least favorite Bond, and this is, you know, people generally around my age, because you grew, you know, as you grew up and started going to movie theater, Roger Moore was James Bond for, I want to say 12 to 15 years. So that was the James Bond when they started going to the movie theater that they grew up with. So that's why I've always felt that Roger Moore was one of the weakest Bonds. But that being said, 1977's The Spy Who Loved Me started off with an amazing, amazing stunt where James Bond, at least the character of James Bond, because I'm pretty sure it wasn't Roger Moore, gets on a pair of snow skis to escape the evil Russians and essentially skis right off a cliff. And as he does that, he opens his parachute. Of course, the British flag is then displayed. It's a tremendous stunt that people still talk about to this day. The Spy Who Loved Me was one of the better Roger Moore James Bonds, I will say that. Although my favorite Roger Moore James Bond was For Your Eyes Only. But this one is very solid, too. Of course, had Ringo Starr's wife, Barbara Bach, who was a very incredibly beautiful woman at the time. But the opening sequence of The Spy Who Loved Me, Barry, that's my number four.
Yeah, you know, the thing with James Bond, too, those movies were also built around a really strong opening sequence. They all had that. So, yeah, it would be hard for me to choose one, though I don't. I think if anything, I think when Daniel Craig took over, those opening sequences really got a shot in the arm as well. And that was probably a change in the times also. You know, what you were doing in, you know, 76. What year did, like, you know, what year did that movie come out?
The 77. One
right. So you're mid-70s, a little different, but you know, you get into the 90s and the 2000s, and certainly the game has changed. But I think the Bond series, they were always known for that, too.
Yeah. Okay, so you're number three, Barry.
So my number three, so this was a tough one, Jeff, because I could have done five Quentin Tarantino movies, but that certainly would have been predictable. So I really had to choose one. And the truth is, Reservoir Dogs, great start. Pulp Fiction, a great start. But there's something about Inglourious Basterds, and I know what it is, and it all boils down to Christoph Waltz. Christoph Waltz, and I believe this was his first movie in this country, or certainly the one that brought him acclaim, the first one to bring him acclaim, but he plays a Nazi, I believe he's a lieutenant, and he goes to a farmhouse, I believe it's in France, and he sits down with the farmer, and they have a conversation, and it's such, you know, this is where Quentin Tarantino is, this is a strong point, is the dialogue.
Oh yeah, and of course.
He's a master of dialogue. It's what it is. It all comes down to the dialogue, and the dialogue between Christoph Waltz and this farmer is, and it's Christoph Waltz carrying the scene, obviously. It's at a different level. It's the way it's written and the way it's performed is at a different level. And it's probably a 10-minute conversation. And as it turns out, the farmer is hiding his daughters underneath the floorboards of the house. But Christoph Waltz has been aware of this the entire time, which makes that conversation that they just had even more interesting. So it was really tough because I could have chose Kill Bill, you know, whatever. I could have chosen any of them, but Christoph Waltz, and he's that guy. He's taken on a Gene Hackman like role to me, where I could watch Gene Hackman in any movie. I don't give a shit what it is. I'm so transfixed upon him on screen. Christoph Waltz is that guy to me. If he's on screen delivering lines, I'll just sit and watch it. And again, I've never seen him in anything that I didn't like, but eventually that's got to happen. The guy is a fucking stud.
Yeah. He was, of course, also Ernst Stavros Blofeld in Spectre, a recent James Bond movie that came out a few years back. Yeah, I know he's a really, really good actor. And you're right. A guy that every time he's on the screen, he completely grabs you by the throat and makes you pay attention to him. Okay, Barry, my number three. Number three on this list, my number two favorite film of all time, is 1981 from George Miller. It is The Road Warrior. And what the opening scene of this movie is in black and white, it starts off almost like it's a documentary where they are talking about how society. So it's very funny now looking back almost 40 years later, Barry, it's some of the opening scenes of this and some of the things that's going on currently in our world. But it talks about how society broke down because of certain things. and how people began to try to hoard oil and gasoline, and it led down led to the breakdown of society, and people began to turn on one another, and so that the only people survived were the people that became savages, essentially, and the people that were able to escape were the people that were, you know, essentially on the roads, and the people that were able to, you know, maintain a supply of gasoline, and they ruled the highways. And the transition from that documentary style of filmmaking to where George Miller takes you right onto the highway, where Mel Gibson as Max is being chased by a gang of motorcyclists, and they also have cars, trying to get to a spot where a gasoline tanker has crashed. And the way that it transitions from that documentary style to being immediately in the middle of a car chase is absolutely breathtaking to me. And immediately, here I'm going to use that word that I just used, it grabs you by the throat and gets you going right from the beginning of the movie, Barry.
Yeah. And so, you know, you love a movie when you know exactly where you saw the movie. And just like I just talked about, I saw this movie at the old Omni movie theaters in downtown Miami. But you're right. And this is this was another one that you had on your list that I looked at it and I said, that's a great fucking opening right there. It's a great movie, obviously. But this was a revolutionary movie on so many levels, because you had so many imitators film-wise come out over the years that were completely stealing from this. Professional wrestling, I believe, you know, let alone the Road Warriors. But how many guys then copied the Road Warriors, which were taken from this movie?
Oh, yeah.
So really, just this was something that this was just really iconic.
Yeah. No. And so your next movie on the list?
My number two is 1986's Highlander. So this is, I mean, when you talk movie openings, let's look at it. You've got professional wrestling. You got the Freebirds facing, I think it's Greg Gagne, Tonga Kid, and somebody else. You've got Queen doing the music. And then you've got a sword fight where one guy is beheaded in the parking lot of the building where wrestling is taking place. So to me,
that doesn't happen very often at a wrestling.
Oh, no, no, no. That almost never happens, Jeff. So, this was another one. I could tell you exactly the night that I saw this. I could tell you where I had fucking dinner this night, Jeff. That's how dialed in I am to it. So this movie was really impactful, but obviously being a big wrestling fan when this movie came out, and especially the Freebirds in 86. So sitting in the theater, having no idea what this movie was about and what was going to take place, this opening scene had me hooked. That point, I don't think I blinked the rest of the movie because I was so into it. And to this day, this is one of the movies on my DVR that I will watch all the time. But what a great opening sequence.
Yeah, you had recommended that I watch this movie, and I did get a chance to watch it. You know, I'm not as big a fan as you are, but it was a good movie, fun movie. Sean Connery is in it, which is always a plus for me. Yep. So, yeah. And of course, you have the wrestling aspect, too. My number two opening scene begins underneath the water as the camera slowly creeps its way through some coral and some vines underneath the water. And then you slowly are hit with that bump, 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 bump. And you cut back to the beach, and a young couple that has been at the beach party is running to take a swim at night. The guy is a little drunker than the young woman, and he passes out on the dunes, and the woman decides to go in for a nightly dip. I don't know, was she skinny dipping or no?
I believe she was skinny
dipping. She was, yeah. And she goes into the water, and she's trying to get the guy's attention to come out and join her, when suddenly she's jerked from down below and realizes very quickly that she's in a lot of trouble. And
that's happened to me, Jeff. I've been jerked from down below, and I realize I'm in a lot of trouble when that happens.
Sure? You weren't in a lot of trouble then.
Oh, okay.
But this young woman was in a lot of trouble because she's basically been bitten in half. But yeah, the opening scene is Steven Spielberg's epic Jaws, especially the use of the music as you see the shark beginning to approach her, and you don't know, you know, you're unsure what it is other than the fact that, you know, it's some sort of sea creature. But yeah, that's just such an iconic opening scene, Barry.
Oh, Jeff. So when you shot me your list, with the exception of the James Bond movie that you discussed, there were four movies on there. I just mentioned Raiders of the Lost Ark, which you were talking about. I think that's the best opening. This is probably the second best opening of any film. And this, again, you know, there isn't a human being alive that wasn't aware of that scene when this movie came out, you know, 45 years ago. Because I think it scared a lot of us off the beach, at least for a few months, because it was so frightening. But that is an amazing scene. You know, I couldn't love the movie Jaws anymore than I already do. And it's on cable every day at this point, every summer. I think they look and they go, all right, beginning in July till the end of August, we're just going to play it once a day on some fucking channel, and it'll be on. And I can tune into this movie at any point and watch it. That's how much I love this film. But that opening sequence, that's got to be one of the best. Absolutely.
And by the way, I should mention that it's also a 5-week run of Shark Week on Discovery Channel.
Yes. So, you know. Jeff, have you ever heard the possible unsolved mystery associated with this?
With Shark Week or with Jaws?
With Jaws. And I have to try to remember exactly what it was. So when they find, and if you Google this, I'm sure it'll be a lot more clear than I'm about to describe it, because this won't make any fucking sense. But when they find the body of the girl that had gone swimming, remember when they find the body?
Yes.
Right in the beginning. And it's not the same girl that went swimming, obviously, but apparently that girl was also, that extra was murdered. And there were photos of her, and I think they were trying to track her down or something. Like, nobody knew her name, the girl that was the body in the sand. But I guess there's a photo out there that shows who it is, and I believe she's been murdered.
About the girl that was in the scene in the water.
No, right, exactly. It's two different people. Not that, okay. That girl was smoking. And I think she either just died or something, but I read a story about her within the last year, 6 months. But it's the girl that's in the sand, because it's a different person.
Okay.
But there's something attached to it. And if you remember, Google that, because again, I'm sure I'm leaving out really important details with this, but there is something to it.
Okay. So your number one all-time favorite opening scene to a movie, Barry?
1985's Reanimator, also my seventh favorite film of all time. This was the film when we did our thing 2.5 years ago. We talked about our favorite films. This was one that I put over. And the big thing for me with this one was there was a unique shock value to this film. Today, if you released it, it probably wouldn't make as much a big a deal as, you know, a lot of films do, you know. But in 1985, this was absolutely huge. And the scene that I always referred to, there's a scene later on in the film where, and what the film about is, a doctor has created a formula to bring bodies back to life, to reanimate them. This is based off of H.P. Lovecraft. And it's not that they come back and they're perfect, because they're not. They're far from it. But it regenerates them where they can move and do things. They can't talk. They can't do any of that. So there's a scene towards the end where they've shot up this body with so much of this shit that the intestines come out of the body and start to strangle people. And I remember being high as a kite in the movie theater in 1985, just popping like fucking Okada just won his first title. Like, I'm jumping up and down. And my girlfriend at the time is looking at me going, calm down. Could you calm down a little bit? Like, you know, like, she's embarrassed that I'm so excited by this. The opening sequence, though, which sets the tone for the entire movie, is you've got a professor walking with two police as a nurse or an administrator is outside of an office, and they're hearing all these screams in there and all these weird noises. So they knock on the door to get access, and they don't open up the door, and the cops break the glass, like I just heard breaking glass in the background. And they open it up, and when they open it up, there is Dr. Herbert West with a syringe full of this green shit and a doctor who's Dr. Gruber. It's not Dr. Hans Gruber, though, that we know from Die Hard, but this is Dr. Gruber, and he is shaking. He's violently shaking. He's got blood coming out of his mouth. And the four people that have just walked in are completely stunned. Dr. Gruber stands up. He grabs his head. Blood is flowing. His eyes bulge out of his head and then squirt blood all over the nurse. He falls to the ground, and the administrator looks at Dr. West and says, "You've killed him." And he says, "I didn't kill him. I gave him life," which is how the whole movie starts. And it was such a fucking iconic scene. And it's only 2 minutes, if even. It's like 90 seconds, but it's so impactful. And then it goes right into the theme of the movie. And the theme song is fantastic. It's done by a guy named Richard Band, who did a lot of horror movies back in the 80s. And I think he's still around. And it's definitely a takeoff of like the movie Psycho. You can definitely hear parts of Psycho. It's just been kind of reimagined. Fantastic opening. My absolute favorite without hesitation.
Okay.
Jeff, you've never seen this movie.
I've never seen it, no.
All right.
I enjoy, as does the audience, stories of you being high as a kite at the movie theater, though. So my number one, when I came out with, you know, when I saw this posted, I think it was somebody had posted this top five on Twitter when I decided to use it. And I knew from the get-go that this, in my opinion, was my all-time favorite opening scene to a movie. The movie itself is not anywhere as good as the sequel, which I've already discussed at number three. I'm talking 1979 George Miller, director George Miller, twice in here. The opening scene to the movie Mad Max is absolutely, doesn't just grab you by the throat. They take the other hand and grab you by the balls to make sure that you're watching and paying attention as the Knight Rider is speeding his way through the outback of Australia and is being chased by the police. And there in his car waiting by the side of the road is Max all they call him is Max. I forget his last name. But the Knight Rider has found his way onto the channel that the police are on. And so you hear not only the police chasing him, but his response to the police. Now, among the things that you see during this open 6 to 7 minutes of this movie, you see a car going through a trailer. You see one of the highway patrol get knocked out of commission, not once, I believe twice. You see one of the officers take a piece of steel to the throat. You see a young child crossing the street pushing a baby carriage that is taken on both sides by two cars speeding, and they go right on either side of him. It's an incredible scene as his parents are watching, and you're sitting there thinking to yourself, they're not really going to take this kid out in the opening scene of the movie. But then the Knight Rider, who is in the car with his skag girlfriend, as the police call her,
yeah,
who has the hair dyed, I don't know, like deep red. And then Max, who's on the police force, joins the chase. And as he's joining the chase, these famous words are uttered from the Knight Rider: "The toe cutter. He knows who I am. I am the Knight Rider. I am the chosen one, the mighty hand of vengeance sent down to strike the unroadworthy. I'm hotter than a rolling dice. Step right up, chum, and watch the kid lay down a rubber road right to freedom." And right after he says this, Max comes up from behind him. He begins crying because he knows he's been caught, and Max takes him out. And holy shit, Barry, like I said, this opening 6 to 7 minutes is absolutely brilliant. The rest of the movie is good. It's not great. There are problems with the voiceover, because I understand at the time Mel Gibson had such a strong Australian accent that they had to dub his voice. And so you see some of the dubbing problems that they have. It's It's a good movie. It's not great, but the opening scene is incredible in this movie, Barry.
Yeah, I like the movie a lot. It definitely. So the interesting thing too, and for those that are not as old as Jeff and myself, which is probably a lot of our listeners, The Road Warrior actually made its way to theaters first before Mad Max did in this country. Though Mad Max had been filmed, I think was 2 years earlier. So
originally it was called Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior.
Right. So it was when they released it in the U.S., it was just The Road Warrior because we hadn't seen Mad Max. And it was such a stunning movie. It was so amazing that they wound up releasing Mad Max within 6-8 months, something like that. And it definitely isn't as good as The Road Warrior. At the same time, though, it was still a really good movie. But yes, the opening sequence is kind of the entire movie.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And by the way, just for Mr. Rose, I saw this at the Lauderhill Mall Theaters, which is also where I saw Jaws, since you tend to remember where you saw the movie. Okay, Barry, you about ready for the go home, my friend?
Well, Jeff, before we do go, how about a little extra bonus restaurant?
Oh, that's right. You did tell me about that. A restaurant that was featured prominently in the old Facebook group.
Yeah, so Chaps Pit Beef opened up a Philly
Real
location.
Pit Beef, I believe.
Real Isn't Pit it? Beef. I think that's Sonny's Real Pit Barbecue, right? Which we know, coming from the state of Florida, which they're everywhere. But so they opened up, I believe it's their first location outside of the Baltimore area. And it opened up in Media, Pennsylvania, suburb of Philly. It's about 35 minutes from my house and opened up, I believe, last Tuesday. So about 6-7 days ago. And our old friend Jamie Ward was very excited. He posted that he was going to go, and he did go. Jamie, I didn't get that invite, by the way. And he went, he posted photos and was kind in his review, though it was a very almost a non-committal type of review. So I saw it, and this was Saturday night, and I said to the kids, guys, you want to go out and eat? And we were going to go to Mission Barbecue, and we go to places that, first off, I'm not really too much on dining indoors these days. I want to eat outside of the table, but I also like to bring Ozzy, and they have outdoor tables. So I was like, why don't we make the move here? These sandwiches are amazing. We'll have a great experience. Let's go check it out. So we arrived about 6:05. How's that for a very subtle kind of plug? But we arrived at right around 6:05 that night, and it wasn't that busy. The restaurant inside was maybe half full. There was maybe 5 people standing around waiting for their food. But we looked at the menu. There's a lot of options. I think one of the flaws of this restaurant is that they offer too much. And you go to Mission Barbecue, and they offer like 10 items, and that's it. But you get your food within 3 or 4 minutes. So it's a model that works. And Chaps, there's a lot. They've got, the menu's like 2 or 3. It's almost the Cheesecake Factory of quick serve. But at the same
That's the gold standard of multiple items on the menu, for sure.
Yeah, but to their credit, they also do it right, Cheesecake Factory. But their kitchen also lets them do it right. So we ordered. We ordered 2 sandwiches. We ordered 2 orders of fries, one with gravy. My daughter got the chicken fingers and fries, and Zach got an order of buffalo wings, as well as was eating one of those sandwiches. So we placed our order, and the girl up front was not that friendly. And in hindsight, I think she was probably praying for the day that all of the problems in the restaurant go away. And I've been there. Everybody she deals with is probably unhappy. She's stressed out. I don't think she was trained properly, but she was kind of a douche. And I say that because it was 93 degrees out. And I said, hey, do you have a container that I could fill with water for my dog? And she said, I don't know. And I said, how about one of those plastic to-go containers? I could put water in there. And she said, well, I don't know if I'm allowed to give those out. So immediately I wanted to pull her over the counter, and I didn't. So I exit the restaurant. And as I'm exiting, a guy with this is about 6:15 now, a guy with an eye patch is walking in. Turns out he is the guy who's going to be expediting the food to get the food out of the kitchen because they're having an issue with it. So he says, hey, I can get you a bowl of water. Well, 10 minutes go by. He's expediting the food. He's not bringing out a bowl of water. And I understand that.
Yeah, so, poor Ozzy's thirsty, though.
Poor Ozzy is thirsty. And this guy completely just said, I'll get you a bowl of water. And then just that was it. He was gone. But then there's this kindly older man that's walking around. He's bussing tables. He's introducing himself to people. He's changing garbages. He's not going anywhere near the kitchen, but he's taking care of the little things in the front of the house. So what that signals to me, Jeff, is that he has zero kitchen experience and knows that if he goes back there, he's going to only be in the way. And I respect that, because at the end of the day, if you don't know what you're doing, don't ever go near the kitchen, because it's already a shit show. Don't get in the middle of it. So he knew that, and I do respect that. So he sees us waiting, and he goes, let me get you a container of water for your dog. He does exactly what I said. He gets a to-go container, puts the water in, gives it to Ozzy. So we're waiting. It's now 32 minutes since we've placed our order. So he walks over, and he says, I'm very sorry. He goes, let me check on your order for you. Now, he approached me. I didn't go to him. And he looks and he said, it's been 32 minutes. He goes, this is completely unacceptable. I'd like to offer you a refund. And I said, no. I said, I get it. I said, I understand. I said, you're new. You know, and the truth is, it's my fault. You never go to a restaurant within the first week of opening. You never go to a restaurant within the first month of opening, because
they got to work out the kinks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They have to never go on an opening day, but never go within the first week, 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So time goes by, Jeff. We're now at 50 minutes. And, and what's irritating me about this is twofold. One is, you've got this guy in the kitchen with the eye patch. He's very loud. And, every time somebody picks up their food, everybody's disgruntled because everybody's been waiting. And every time somebody picks up their food, he, in a very loud voice, says, I apologize for the delay. Enjoy your meal. And what he's doing is he's projecting himself as an authority figure on the diner. And because he's incompetent and he can't do his job, he's going to talk louder and try to come off like he's a tough guy. So I watched this and I saw it five times. So this wasn't a one-off. I saw it multiple times. At that point, you've got an employee that brought in his girlfriend and another friend. I'm going to assume high school kids to eat that night. He's now been waiting 35 minutes. He's upset. He's waiting 35 minutes and he's upset. The guy with the eye patch starts giving him his food. I'm now waiting 50 minutes. So I go up to the older guy, who it turns out is a former Philadelphia sports writer named Paul Hagan, which I find out from Jamie after the fact. I don't know him. Jamie does. Nicest guy ever, too. This is not, you know, this guy did everything he could. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take you up on your offer of the refund. We're at 50 minutes, but I think we actually have to leave. Because at this point, I just want to get the fuck out of there. I don't want to be there any longer. He says, no, I'm going to refund your money, but I want to be able to give you the food. Let me go back there and get it. He goes back, talks to the guy in the eye patch. 2 minutes later, we get our bag of food without the French fries. The French fries will be an additional 5 minutes. I mean, this is not just amateur hour. This is next level amateur hour. Even if you fuck up, we're at a different level at this stage. So I bring the food out, and I got to admit, the kids are handling this extremely well. I'm kind of ticked off at the way the whole, not at Paul Hagan either, but my assumption on this thing is the guy with the eye patch is one of two people. He's either a partner of Paul Hagan, that is trying to, he's a partner in this restaurant, or he's a manager that has somehow been able to convince a guy with no restaurant experience that he's qualified. Where my indictment of this guy with the eye patch comes in is he walked into the restaurant, Jeff, at 10 after 6. If you are a fucking manager on a Saturday night, you don't walk into your restaurant at 10 after 6. And I said it to my wife. My wife said, well, maybe there was a death in the family. Maybe something happened. Then you take the shift off. You don't walk into a restaurant at 10 after 6 because they're already knee deep. You've got employees that are high school kids that have only been working for 5 days. they have no fucking idea what they're doing. And if you don't have a leader, you're totally fucked. So this guy walks in. So if he's a manager, he's been able to convince the guy with no restaurant experience that he's qualified. If he is a part owner, where the fuck were you until 10 after 6? You're supposed to be there at 4 o'clock before this shift even starts. So it was just a shit show. Turns out I get home that night and my wife says, why are there two charges for $47 on the credit card? Exactly, Jeff. Exactly. So I've talked about that. That whole experience was a nightmare. I won't go back for a few months. I will tell you the good and bad with the food. The barbecue sauces are good. They make some of their own barbecue sauces, and they've got five that are in one of the squirty machines, so you can get your own barbecue sauce. I like that. The sandwiches are phenomenal. So the pit beef is beef. They do ham. They do turkey. And it's grilled over charcoal. So it really picks up this charcoal flavoring. So I got a pit beef sandwich. Zach got pit beef and ham. They were both, spectacular. Loved it. The big disappointment were the French fries. And if you fuck up your French fries, we have an issue here. So the French fries, they appear to be hand cut because they were thick potato. They were browned. Some had skin on, but they were also soggy as shit. The sad part is the fries were actually too hot to even eat because they had just come out of the fryer. And I give them credit for not serving me cold fries. However, if a fry's coming out of the fryer, you expect there's going to be some crisp factor to it. Zero. Literally, these were so laden with oil, which again, telling you somebody doesn't know what they're doing. So the fries were a huge disappointment. The chicken fingers tasted odd. Not a good experience overall. I will go back sandwiches only down the road when they get their shit together, because I got to tell you, that's a really good sandwich and I really enjoy it. Everything else was a massive fail, though.
All right. Well, now we will officially do the go home. I would tell you that on behalf of our producers, the sweet man, sweet Lou Kippelman, very happy that his Giants split the series with the Dodgers this weekend, is our producer. We always appreciate his efforts. And on behalf of myself and Barry Rose, we are a production. I remember this week, Lou, of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And until next week, folks, we will talk with you later.